Yeah.
Oh, we're
Oh, sorry.
pronunciation with us.
Well, you've got Brian's sandwich.
All right, welcome everyone. We're going to begin our morning panel, our morning session, titled Histories of Humanitarianism and Visual Media. Welcome. My name's Stephanie Van Garth, and I'm a historian at King's University College, and it's my great pleasure to introduce the panel members today and to guide you through our session. Just by way of note, this panel brings together two highly dynamic fields in transnational history, the history of humanitarianism, and visual history. What this panel aims to do is to analyze the role of visual media, encompassing photography, film, and television, in humanitarian discourses. They concentrate specifically on two periods of acceleration in humanitarian action that occurred in the first half of the 20th century. The Great War and its aftermath through in the 1960s coincided with innovation in media and communications technologies. Our four esteemed panelists today include Sonia Delatte, a postdoctoral fellow at McMaster University, whose research interests include histories of humanitarian photography, ethics and the moral principles of viewing photographs of suffering, photography and social justice. Valerie Gorin is a lecturer and researcher, Center for Education and Research in Humanitarian Action, a joint center of the University of Geneva and the Graduate Institute. Her published work focuses on the mediatized conflict and visual news framing. Sunke Kündel is a junior professor for North American history at the Free University of Berlin in Germany. His research interests include American history in a global context, global media, history of development, natural disasters, global cities, and humanitarianism. And last but certainly not least, Dominique Marshall is professor and chair in the history department at Carleton University. Her research interests include child welfare, Child Welfare Committee of the League of Nations, Oxfam, humanitarian aid, rights of children, disability. She also serves as coordinator for the Canadian Network on Humanitarian History, and if you don't know about that, you should sign up. And she's also a co-principal researcher for the Carleton University Disability Research Group. Just by way of note today, we're going to be doing a bit of a different format for today's session. Our panelists will each speak for 10 minutes, and thereafter, I will be asking them a series of pre-arranged questions for about 40 minutes, and then afterwards, we aim to have about 15 to 20 minutes left over for questions from you all, the engaged audience today. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome our first presenter, Sonia Delatte. Thank you, Stephanie, for that lovely introduction. And thank you, everybody, for making it out here this morning at 8:30, bright and early. In the interest of time, I'm going to jump right in. Let's see. So the question here on this first slide is emerged, as research questions often do, out of several different influencing factors. First, it was my deep personal interest in the role of history in reflecting on current issues, or as historian Robert Darnton describes, history as being a way of gaining perspective on the present. That's not an invitation for anachronism, but it's more about historical thinking, so grounding the present in the past. The second influencing factor is my postdoctoral fellowship with the Humanitarian Health Ethics Research Group, which focuses on contemporary moral experiences around palliative care for refugees on the part of international aid workers currently operating in places such as Jordan and Rwanda. So this postdoctoral work might seem wildly unrelated to my presentation today, but taking my first point to heart, looking at visual culture of refugeedom, so the conditions and experiences of being a refugee, through photographs made a century ago, I believe helps us gain a perspective on contemporary discourse and public imagination of refugees that are shaping responses and policies towards refugees today. Lewis Hine is best known to this day for two photo projects done before the First World War. His first photo project was of immigrants arriving at Ellis Island in New York City around 1906 and 1909. Oh, sorry, the timing is going on its own. Let's hope it stays. And this initial project with the immigrants arriving at Ellis Island on the right-hand side was meant to encourage...
thought I had taken the timing out. There we go. Okay. Sorry about that. So that initial project was meant to encourage the same regard for contemporary immigrants as for the pilgrims who landed at Plymouth Rock, and was intended to be a counter discourse to rampant xenophobia that existed in the United States at the turn of the early 20th century. This project already signaled a pattern of rising and falling sympathies towards newcomers in public discourse, imagination, and political policy. He's also probably more well-known for the photographs on the left of his work for the National Child Labor Committee in their campaign against child labor. Hein was trained as a sociologist and an educator. He was not a journalist, but a social reformer whose main medium of advocacy was the camera. By the mid-19-teens, Hein had already developed a reputation as the most extensive and successful photographer of social welfare work in America. Hein would hone his skills while shining light on Europe's civilians' wartime needs at the same time as making the American Red Cross shine as America's preeminent relief agency. So initially there was a strong opposition to America joining the war overseas. The influential peace movement and the government didn't consider it America's place to meddle in the affairs of other countries. Many Americans, however, supported large-scale civilian activities through the Herbert Hoover's Commission for Relief in Belgium and the American Committee for the Near East Relief. When the war went on for years longer than expected, ideas of internationalism gained momentum, as it had become apparent, even to some in the peace movement, that in order for domestic social issues to be properly addressed, peace in Europe was necessary. When America entered the war in 1917, the Red Cross's newsletter was turned into a full-fledged magazine with large color illustrations, and it listed amongst its rivals the Saturday Evening Post and Good Housekeeping. The magazine hired social progressive authors and artists such as Louis Hein for their skills at building affect and raising consciousness. The magazine became the most influential humanitarian magazine at the time, the product of an organization that at the height of the war boasted nearly one-third of the American population amongst its members. And this is a photograph of Louis Hein standing up on a fence holding his big box camera, taking photographs of an elderly couple of refugees coming from Belgium into northern France. In the summer of 1918, readers leafing through the July edition would encounter an 8-page photo essay in which Europe's refugees would stake a claim on American sentiments, however briefly. As a group of people that appeared in the public arena virtually overnight, no internationally recognized legal definition existed for this group. The term refugee had been resurrected during the Great War's early years, expanding from its original meaning of religious persecution to encompass all people fleeing persecution and seeking safety. Although considered hapless wartime victims in the war's early years, this photo spread of the Red Cross's sympathetic portrayal of refugees was, by 1918, already a counter-narrative to debate and anxiety about refugees that had begun to circulate. It is in many ways a typical example of what Thomas Lacour has termed a humanitarian narrative. The pictures divide the narrative into innocent victims fleeing from persecution only to arrive in the Red Cross's loving, nurturing arms. As the war came to a close, the American Red Cross still saw a need to maintain a presence in Europe. Instead of returning stateside, Louis Hein was invited to be the photographer of a special survey team that would generate, and I quote, a scientifically studied picture of the comparative necessities of the various countries in the line of work which we, the Red Cross, have been engaged. So visual culture scholars will often base much of their analysis on the way in which photographs have been used or the conditions in which pictures develop what Elizabeth Edwards has called a social life. But Louis Hein's special survey pictures almost have no social life to speak of. Of the approximately 1,000 photographs that he produced in Italy, Serbia, Greece, and Belgium between November 1918 and April 1918, the Red Cross would publish fewer than a handful. That's why I propose instead to build on Ariella Azoulay's ideas of watching his photographs to reconstruct what little social life they had. Instead of simply looking at photographs, watching a picture is fundamentally an act of historical thinking. It entails, and I quote, dimensions of time and movement that need to be reinscribed in the interpretation of the still photographic image. This action, according to Azoulay, and I quote again, reconstructs the photographic situation and allows a reading for the injury, or I would say in this case, affect or condition, inflicted on the others as a civic skill, not an exercise in aesthetic appreciation. In watching these photographs, it becomes apparent that Hein was contributing to the construction of a definition of refugees at a time when there wasn't any. The content and themes in Hein's refugee-labeled photographs contain elements that are repeated in pictures of today's refugees. He frequently pictured family groups with children front and center, burdened under the weight of their worldly possessions as they traveled cross-country by foot along dusty or muddy roadways or along the rail lines. Perseverance, ingenuity, capacity to labor despite drive despite loss were all themes Hine built into his images and were ones expected to be of that American audiences could relate to. All the while, he deliberately focused on expressions of hope or at least positive qualities of resilience and resourcefulness. I interpret what Hine was doing along the lines of philosopher Richard Rorty's concept of sentimental education, where narratives in the captions and representations in the pictures have the potential to, and I quote, to expand the reference of terms of our kind of people and people like us, to include people who might otherwise have been considered other or them. Watching the photographs in Azoulay's sense can return to us clues as to Hines' intentions and perceptions. It also gives a somewhat rich glimpse into refugeedom, but it is their lack of use that is another source of historical significance. By the early months of peace, refugees, once foundational to the American Red Cross's reputation and practice, were being outmaneuvered by a narrowing of humanitarian idealism as the wartime sense of international humanitarianism being a patriotic duty was replaced by an insular nationalistic fervor. What transpired was a loss of attention to refugees' needs as there was a narrowing of focus on children as the idealized symbol of humanitarian attention. Now, there's a whole body of literature around the emergence of children as a dominant humanitarian figure that I just, for the sake of time, I can't get into. So instead, I'm going to jump to my overall conclusion. You can see the displacement of the refugees. So my intention with my dive into the American Red Cross and Lewis Hines' archives is meant to contribute to reflections on new directions for humanitarian photography, something that's been the cause of considerable critique and experimentation for, I would say, the last 2 to 3 decades. In particular, I embrace this idea of John Berger's and encourage the construction of a radial system around photographs so that the pictures and all they come to represent continue to exist in time instead of being arrested moments. Which then brings me back to my initial question. And through this process of watching pictures rather than looking, what also can develop, according to the theories of Ariella Azoulay, is what she has termed potential histories. So in watching photographs, our minds are open to trajectories that might have happened and mechanisms of control been different or non-existent. Exploring potential histories is an act of challenging official memory and dominant histories that obscure or deny spectators' ability to judge situations from multiple perspectives, let alone recognize their being implicated or even implicit in them. So historical thinking and potential histories of the current refugee crisis can lead to questions such as, what discursive and imaginary opportunities emerge when comparing historical and contemporary photographs of refugeedom? What happens to the discourse once a civil space is opened up through the presence of the camera? What might have happened had the American Red Cross published a large photo spread of post-war refugees and reconstruction needs from that special survey and framed them as needs that Americans were ideally positioned to respond to? How might that have impacted political policies such as the 1924 Johnson-Reed Act, which emerged in response to First World War refugees seeking settlement in North America? Given that Hine ascribed the term refugee in his captions to only certain types of people while calling others beggars or nomads, what might this reveal in terms of histories of limits to humanitarian imagination or the politics of naming today? So I'm not sure yet what such a humanitarian slash historical photography might look like or what sorts of lines of questions or directions of actions such an approach to the creation, use, and spectating of such humanitarian photographs might lead. But in a moment in which there are approximately 66 million forcibly displaced people around the globe, of which some 23 million are refugees according to the UN definition, a historical perspective can open new lines of inquiry or different ways of seeing the situation. Thank you very much.
Good morning, everyone. So My presentation today is going to focus on advocacy as a concept, which is a recent field of investigation in humanitarian history. It is merely understood as a form of communication that collides with the politicization of aid. By its very early use by humanitarian organizations in the context of the 20s especially, was linked to its original meaning. At that time, advocacy would mean more speaking on behalf of or showing the grief of people unable to do so. So already in the 20s, advocacy emerged as a visual strategy and a practice among humanitarian organizations who actually followed what human rights activists had been doing since the very late 19th century. At that time, groups who were active, for example, in the Congo, would use visual media in order to denounce atrocities or political issues related to aid, in order to mobilize or convince audiences to act. So the project I'm developing since a year is related to understanding visual advocacy as it was made by humanitarian organizations in the beginning of the 20th century as a set of communication practices requiring knowledge skills, and it was related at that time to the professionalization of communication, but also the relations of this humanitarian organization with the media, especially journalists, and of course the idea of public mobilization. And these communication practices were linked with the knowledge skills that were required to produce these advocacy strategies, but also a visual rhetoric that started to be shaped by humanitarian organization or human rights organization, and the visual culture they shaped, they shared among them. So the period I focus on for this presentation relates to the Eastern European famine between 1919 and 1923. It was a very important moment for visual advocacy, especially because it was a moment where the first humanitarian movies were produced, but also because of the highly politicized context of the post-World War I intervention in Europe, especially in Bolshevik Russia or in Germany, and also because of the growing competitive markets in the humanitarian sector. So the material I've been working on lately includes pictures, but mainly movies that were produced by the ICRC, Save the Children Found, the American Relief Administration, who had just been created in 1919 by Herbert Hoover to intervene in Eastern Europe, and the Nearest Relief, which was a missionary group also active in Armenia during and after the genocide. So the images that were produced by these four organizations, these four main actors at that time, images which included photography, posters, as we saw with Sonia, but also especially cinema, were produced for communication strategies that were still perceived as similar. At that time, the organization was struggling to define really what it was as a type of material. Some organizations were talking about publicity, which had the meaning of giving a public image or visibility upon something. Some of them would rather talk about social education movie, which aimed at raising awareness, more or less, or even humanitarian propaganda, as we saw also with the pictures from the Red Cross magazine. And in this case, it was more intended for increasing the image, the identity, or the reputation of the organization. And this whole organization would act mainly for advocacy purposes that were related either in defining the impartiality of beneficiaries, children's rights, and Dominique has written extensively about that, refugees' rights, as we saw with Sonia, but also the need to fight against epidemic diseases. So, as I said, advocacy rose as a time of increasing professionalization among humanitarian organizations. All of them will open either film units, like in the League of Red Cross, propaganda unit in the ICRC, or publicity unit, especially in ARA, Nearest Relief, and Save the Children Found. These units were concretely dedicated to producing images and fundraising material, but also propaganda material. And they were usually hiring local cameramen or journalists to produce these movies with their own budget, which would be a problem also with their donors. But more importantly, and I think that's more interesting, they learned from others. And there were some knowledge transfers among organizations related to the circulation of activists. So the first free woman I've been working on lately are a good example of women who came working for these NGOs, bringing the savoir-faire from early contexts. So Anna Rutry, for example, was a Quaker involved in the Second Boer War, in which she became involved with working with the British National Press. So later she was hired by Save the Children. She was sitting in the board of Save the Children, and she was in charge of the relations with the press during the famine in Russia. Also, Emily Hobhouse is probably the most famous of all these three women. She was also an activist during the Second Boer War. She became famous for using pictures of starving children, and she would later work for the International Union of Save the Children in 1920 in Germany and Austria, and her reports were published also together with the broadcasting of the movies. And finally, Amalia Likourezou. She was a nurse working for Nearest Relief in Greece, where she became involved in producing visual material, especially pictures. And she will later work for the Greek Red Cross, and she will become famous in 1941. She was the first to take pictures of children dying from the British blockade, who produced the famine in Greece in 1941. So all these three women learned how to produce advocacy material, fundraising material, using visual images or especially pictures, but also movies. And as they started to work for these humanitarian organizations, they contributed in building and promoting social practices around using and seeing images. So humanitarian organization therefore observed what the others did, learned from the others, competed with the others, as we see in the words of William Herford, who is showing his perplexity towards publicity in the columns of the International Review in the Red Cross in February 1920, where he says, among the sciences launched and developed during the World War, none has had more influence than the final on the final outcome than the science involving a striking and rapid display of information to the public. This science is so recent that it is impossible to find a proper naming. It is named publicity for the lack of a better denomination. The word propaganda could be used if misused, hidden, deceitful attempts had not been made during the war to influence the English and American opinion. We could use the word education. Real publicity is the dissemination of light on what remains in the shadow or in the night, so every human being can equally see and choose by himself what is good. So we clearly see here how much there is still a confusion between publicity, propaganda, and education. So visual advocacy, as I said, also emerged as at a moment of convergence between mass media, new technologies, publicity, and entertainment practices. Humanitarian cinema, on which I'm focusing today, was used at that time as a form of speaking on behalf of people or raising awareness on certain issues. And it's very interesting to understand how it can act to persuade people to mobilize or to act beyond political or ideological division. So we can observe three forms of cinema that were created at that time. The first, I call it accountability cinema, for the lack of a better word, which was used mainly as a form of gratification. In this case, it was the movie produced by ARA in 1923 at the end of their intervention in Russia called America's Gift to Famine-Stricken Russia, which shows in this case that food had been going where it should go. In this case, in this stage scene that we see here, we see civilians saying directly thank you to the US public, and we have this information provided with the words entire remaining population of the village fell on their knees in thanks as first food is brought by the American Relief Administration. So it's a way to say thank you back to the American public, but it's also a way to depoliticize a highly political context by focusing on innocent victims. The second type of cinema that was produced is called educational cinema, using the, and this, in this case, it's a cinema, it's a type of cinema that uses mainly the language of science, which was typical of ICRC movies at that time, such as The Fight Against Typhus, which was produced by the ICRC in 1921. These movies were produced more as social campaigns to educate the people to fight epidemic disease at a time where hygiene and public health was a growing matter. It is produced as a scientific discourse to plead for the end of epidemic disease by educating people to choose an appropriate behavior. in front of disease. And last type of cinema, which is more interesting when we speak about advocacy, is mobilizing cinema, which uses more the melodrama tone, such as this famous movie that was produced by Save the Children and made by the journalist G.H. Muse, called Famine in Russia in 1921, which uses emotions and affect to sensitize and mobilize people to act and to feel towards distant strangers. So before I conclude, what do we mean when we speak about mobilization through the image at the time? Mobilizing cinema in particular is interesting because it is clearly based on visual and discursive strategies denouncing the causes of suffering. This type of movies emphasize first atrocity images, which are related to the exhibition of death, such as this first picture, which is also taken from the movie Famine in Russia, who, instead of the traditional feelings of empathy or compassion, aims at provoking shame or guilt. But they also include about-to-die images, such as this starving child, which means that it's not too late to save them. And these images combine with injunctions to help, such as these words that say, do not forget the emaciated faces of these children, their thin leather arms, let this be your, let this be to you like a nightmare until you have done your duty towards those who are starving. So these images combined with these injunctions were morally compelling. So the movie from Save the Children had a large impact on the British audience, convincing donors or journalists that the famine was real because there had been attacks against Save the Children, that they were exaggerating the level of the famine and the intensity of the famine. And as we see in the words of the Manchester Guardian, the movie's Famine in Russia had been broadcasted a bit everywhere in England, and it helped to convince people that what was happening in Russia was real, and the pictures were not enough to convince them, so the movie was a necessary thing to convince them. So to conclude, the image, especially the mechanical or the moving one, is therefore perceived as an ultimate proof at that time, a convincing piece of evidence, as Save the Children reminds it to its audience in 1921 in a very famous article that was published in the record of the Save the Children found, called Seeing is Believing, in which they compared the proof with the image as a form of medical or legal proof. As they say, it is a principle of English common law that a coroner's inquisition can only be held super visum corporis, and those of us who had had to fulfill the melancholy duty of taking part in such an inquisition will recall that it is only after viewing the body that the members of the jury proceed to the performance of their oath. Some such motive as this was behind the decision of the Council of the Save the Children Fund to send a photographer to Russia to take a kinematograph picture. So that was the movie Famine in Russia. The Council is now asking the public up and down the country to see the film and to give their verdict according to the evidence and without fear or favor, affection or ill will. So the belief here is grounded in the indexical quality of the film. But what is interesting here is the link with the medical and legal semantics, which shows first that the public is considered as a judge, we see the word jury or verdict, and second, that the proof lies in the body as the locus of pain. And Sonia has been referencing the work of Thomas Lacker, but this is exactly what it is here. Focusing on the body is a way to observe and connect to the reality of the suffering. So therefore, we see that the relation from the public to images already at that time was greatly shaped by the immediacy and the immersive reality provided by the new medium of cinema. And these humanitarian films were displayed in public places, meeting halls, clubs, churches, and enriched by many testimonies from humanitarian workers who came to speak about their experience and calling for the public to act. So the advocacy purpose of such movies became also a performative experience, where the public was asked to take sides and to become a witnessing audience to judge and to act through social gatherings, immersed in humanitarian visual universes, which need to be better defined and understood historically. Thank you.
Technical help. Thank you. Okay. All right, thank you. I'd like to start out with, first of all, thanking Stephanie for chairing this, this session. And secondly, with thanking Dominique for having organized this this panel and this session, and for giving me the, or having given me the experience to you know, visit and attend Congress, or and to experience Congress. It's been a wonderful 2 days so far. So thank you very much for that. Now, you know, as all of you may know, Germans have a certain reputation for always being on time, right? But there's one big difference, or one exception, and that's the genre of the academic presentation, you know, where Germans sort of tend to ramble on and on and on. So, and Stephanie has been very strict in, you know, telling us that we should stick to the 10 minutes, and I'll give my best with that. And I'll plunge immediately into my presentation with that. What I would like to talk about now is the following medium, television. And I would like to specifically inquire into the emerging role of television journalists in the 1960s in the context of the Vietnam War, a war you know, all of you have heard about, the defining event of the 1960s, so to speak. And you'll see you know, the basic milestones and stepping stones of its history on the slide here. The most important thing to remember here is that the war was escalated in the mid-1960s by the United States, which began to deploy ground troops and to bomb North Vietnam beginning in 1965. Now, the argument I would like to make is that the Vietnam War was a, you know, not only a pivotal moment in the history of the Cold War, it was also a pivotal moment in the history of humanitarianism. It politicized a whole generation around the world. It inspired the creation of a whole wave of new humanitarian INGOs around the world. And what it also did, it was also the moment in which television transformed into a medium for humanitarian advocacy. That's what I'd like to argue today. Now, the reason, or now to understand how and why this happened, how television turned into a medium for humanitarian advocacy, it's important to remind ourselves that the way we see the Vietnam War today is very different from the way that people saw it in the 1960s, that television viewers saw it in the 1960s. What they saw was a very different picture of the war far into the year 1966. What they saw was the US government's iconography of the war, so to speak, which is no wonder because most television journalists and photographers relied on the photo and film opportunities that the US military had arranged for them, so they could hop on helicopters and join helicopters on their missions. They could join air jets on their bombing raids to North Vietnam, or they could go into the field as embedded journalists, so to speak. And in all of those instances, TV journalists, as much as photographers, subscribed and represented and reproduced an aesthetic perspective on the war that had been arranged for them. A perspective that promoted an aesthetic view on the war, the spectacle of the war machinery, so to speak. A perspective that typically framed the war from the point of view of the machine gun shooter, so to speak, the bird's eye view and perspective of the war. And the effect of this was that, you know, the war was not only represented as a clean and technological affair on television, as a visual spectacle, you know, of bombs exploding in the jungle and so on. The effect of this perspective was also that the victims of the bombing raids and of the search and destroy missions were rendered invisible on German television as much as in German print media at the time. Now, that picture began to change around 1966, and the reason for that was very much the rise of a new generation of television journalists, in particular in West Germany, the country I'm going to focus on in my presentation. One of those new TV journalists was Hans-Dieter Grabe, an acclaimed documentary filmmaker who established himself in the mid-1960s as Germany's leading TV documentary filmmaker. Born in Dresden in 1937, and thus only 2 years before the start of World War II, Grabe as a child had experienced himself a number of bombing raids himself in West Germany. And in fact, one of those bombing raids on Dresden had burned down the house of his, of his family. And he often used to tell this episode how he was sitting in front of his house on a sofa that had been rescued at the last minute, and how he was watching the house burn down as a child. As a consequence of his own childhood experiences, Grabe had become suspicious of the rosy battle stories that his colleagues, told about the Vietnam War on West German television. He had formed a special sensibility for the existential inhumanity that warfare involved, and he had come to think of war from the perspective of the civilian sufferers it involved. At the same time, he believed in the power of television and the power of the medium, so to speak. He believed that it had the capability to change the way people thought of and engaged with the war. And he felt that as a TV journalist, he had a humanitarian responsibility to draw attention to what the Vietnam War meant for Vietnamese civilians. So what he did in the mid-1960s, in 1966 in particular, was he started to do documentaries about the Vietnam War. He flew to Vietnam and did two very long TV features about the war. One of them titled The Helgoland in Vietnam, done in 1966, and the other one called Only Light Battles Around Da Nang, done in 1970. Both of those documentaries focused on a hospital ship called the Helgoland that the West German Red Cross, as part of the official West German contribution to the war, had sent to Vietnam in 1966. So what Grabe did, he visited the Helgoland, which was based in Saigon Harbor first, and then later in the harbor of Da Nang. He visited the Helgoland, which you can see up there on the slide, and he sort of filmed what the medical doctors and the nurses encountered on board of the Helgoland. In other words, what he did with his TV documentaries was he broke with the established view on the war, of the war as a techno spectacular war aesthetic going on, and he formulated a visual counter narrative to that, a narrative which put the suffering and the human tragedies that warfare involved for Vietnamese civilians at the center. So what TV viewers got to see in long sequences were shattering close-ups of wounded children, wounded women, and other civilians with terrible injuries. And if you watch those movies, they are really, really shocking and upsetting. Viewers could see faces of people torn to pieces with no mouth or nose left, people whose legs had been torn apart, whose whole bodies had been ripped up, in one case even with an intestine creeping out of an open stomach. So just to give you a sense of what those documentaries showed. The documentaries also showed surgeries in all details, and the second one, Only Light Battles Around Da Nang, concluded with showing in multiple close-ups how medical doctors conducted an amputation of the lower leg of a Vietnamese boy, a sequence more than 3 minutes long. So TV viewers really had to, sit through this sequence of 3 minutes. Grabe's documentaries had a tremendous emotional impact on the West German public, as you can imagine. They established a new view on the war within West Germany, and they stood for a change in the representation of the war on West German television. Now, there's also more to them, I think, and I'll just briefly conclude pointing you to three broader insights or three broader perspectives that I think that Grabe's documentaries raise for us as historians being interested in the history of humanitarianism and visual media. First of all, those two documentaries, they stood for a new compassionate moralism in TV reporting as they established a new humanitarian view on the war, on this entertainment medium television. Secondly, they also reflected a broader process in which television sort of transformed into a new social site for formulating new countervisions of humanity. And third, you know, they also invite us to, you know, us as historians of humanitarianism, I think they also invite us to ponder about the agency of television journalists as humanitarian actors, and to take TV journalists, you know, serious as humanitarian actors in their own right. Okay, and I'll conclude with that, and I hope I stayed in the 10 minutes. Okay. Thank you.
Francophones in this room that didn't know in English. Visual media have long been central to children's awareness of the lives of others, to their expressions and actions. My study follows the use of images in development education, what became known as development education, by photographers, illustrators, and educators who were all related to the Canadian International Development Agency from the late 70s to the end of the 20th century. There was a time in the post-war world when much education about the Global South came from government development agencies and NGOs, like many of you have even studied. My project looks at adults' intentions, and it tries to see how children engaged with these different means, and in particular, in this case, with visual media. And so this project comes from a visit that Sonia, who is here, and I made to the CIDA Photo Library as it was shutting down in December 2016. And we met Mark Rockbrunn, who is there in his between his shelves in his office with boxes of materials that he had gathered. In the heyday of educational program of CIDA, there were three people with him between these offices and a shed on Pink Road in Gatineau, and they presided over a system of lists of subscribers, of code cards, of subscription forms like this one, and order forms, film catalogs, and a video library on development, and many of which he has preserved one or two examples of, and he had boxes to give. From his office and the shed, quarterly publications, videos, and catalogs swarmed to public libraries, schools, and the houses of young individuals. He said in an interview I conducted with him that the program was very popular. There was a real need for these materials in schools and in homes. This program by the end of the 80s, and there was a treble impetus for it. There was a UN initiatives on development. There was a need by the Canadian government to build legitimacy in its public, and it started with adults and then young adults and finally children in schools, and also from demands by NGOs, and NGOs who were in the mid-80s getting richer because, sadly, of the famine in Ethiopia, and had a lot of capacity to do development education and were participating in local centers of development education. So this is an article in the CIDA magazine Development on development education, and a picture taken by one of the CIDA photographers that Sonia has studied so well, of activities in a park or in the schoolyard of development education. Photographers of associated with CIDA were put to work, and the UNICEF and UN-sponsored work of Hélène Tremblay, a French-Canadian photographer, was aimed at families. It was family to family, really. And so she was saying family life is the one social experience that is common to all humankind, and sharing this experience of other families all over the world is the world's most powerful force for international understanding among ordinary people that I have ever witnessed. And she had, in her introduction to her book, she talks about how she doesn't want to, the photo speaks by itself. She doesn't want to impose her feelings. My personal opinions might stop you from forming your own. Does it really matter how I feel? Your feelings, as you discover,
those with whom you share the planet are the most important. So for her, pictures were kind of, she could step back and facilitate communication between families. And so then Sida produced an activity sheet. The main objective of the guide was to provide groups with the opportunity to develop positive attitudes towards other cultures by increasing their awareness and understanding of global issues. It is important to nurture the idea that all people's needs are linked in one mutually dependent world.
So because Mark had treble copies, I've inherited some of these stuff that you can have a look at what it looks inside. Also, illustrators were put to work, and in this case, Lucie Chantal, who drew pictures. What's interesting is she drew them all over Sida material. She came to maximum use in the publication of that novel, which was done by a Sida manager who was also a poet, and Blaine Marchand. And it's interesting that the pictures of the novels are based on David Barber's photographs, and then so photo becomes drawings, and these drawings are all over also the catalogs of videos and so forth. And these, so again, you had in French and English, you had the novel and the activity sheet, and the color coding is for different age groups. There was the beginning of high school and the late high school, and that color coding is everywhere in Sida documents. It's interesting also that this material made its way into Sida's activity of education of children outside of Canada. So the maps that were produced, the famous maps of Sida, there was three iterations of that, one of them published with the Canadian Geographic. It was thought in new ways by a Sida communications person. And you have in the Sida photo library pictures of development Sida educators in the field in Nepal and Thailand using Sida maps of the world to do their own education in the field. And so there were these big world maps. Some editions of them have pictures on them. And then you have some leaflets by countries, which were also a beautiful compendium of pictures and maps to explain each country, and you could order all of them or some of them if you wanted. A really strong effort by Media Sphere, the group which was formed by National Film Board people and by Sida people to produce that material for a development education. They produced this really big 60-page long thing, principles of a development education, where they reflect on what children, depending on their age, will get. How long do you speak? What do you speak to? What kind of engagement is most likely to change? And it's really transformative to change their mind. So changes in the individual brought about by the educational process must be rooted in the affective or the emotional, must be the outcome of reflection, and must be more than mere informational or cognitive in nature. And the visual in all that plays a very big role as a trigger for imagination and as a trigger for expression. And it's interesting that the value that Sida and the National Film Board put on artistic expression was also a commitment to generate artistic expressions from children. So these illustrators and photographers were themselves, you could say, a testimony to that commitment to generate some really personal engagement with the material. The main challenge of development education lies in drawing a connection between a distant reality and everyday concerns without lapsing in ethnocentrism, moralizing, or academic and connective comparisons. So these people are also critical in their training, critical development, and are also, you know, the inheritor of what Sunki is talking about. There's a lot of consciousness that they want to avoid these pitfalls that a lot of you have been talking about this morning. So one of the things that is in Rockburn's collection when it made its way to Carlton are artifacts, and this is a game produced by Media Sphere where you have these strips filmed. These were like projections. The Department of National Welfare was also used these things, so you put that in a projector and there's the sound and you have a guide, and then they recycled some of their magazines also that were in the box, and that was to be played with a guide in high school. So part of these psychopedagogical advice, which came from the University of Ottawa Department of Education, said children have to do stuff. They actually have to be active to learn, and they have to be active in small bits when they're young and bigger bits, longer bits when they're old. So these were all sorts of ways to try to engage them with a lot of the visual material otherwise produced by CIDA. And so the magazines were aimed at three different age groups, and they were generating essays and pictures. And so there was in Somewhere Today, the one for the children between 8 and 11, It's Your Turn, was two pages where they were asking children to send drawings and texts. And there was also organized with the Museum of Civilization, I put it here, an essay competition that was a yearly one. And then the magazine was publishing the result of all this in a little insert in their magazine here, the winners of the competition. And I was thinking about that when you were talking. Sonia, the special on refugees is called Starting Over. There's no word refugee in it, but it's about refugees, but they don't use the word refugee. It's all, I'll see how you're renaming stuff, which is interesting. So some discoveries there. There's a lot of recycled adult stuff in it, you know, like I compare myself, they do dutifully what the teachers is asking, you know, when I, my schedule, my parents, my house, their house and all that, they do this kind of lateral comparison. They do a lot, they do quite a bit of compassionate feeling the pain of others, and you know, we're privileged and they're not. But there are some surprises, and so, which speaks to maybe these invitations. There are suggestions. I would like to have recipes. I would like you to talk about the environment. And then the magazine is answering, well, it's not so quite. We don't want to talk about that. You're too young for this. But wait a bit. We're talking about it in the next magazine when you get older. There's also really cool questions like, do you keep all our letters? And they say yes, but I don't know if they probably were all thrown away. And there are also questions about, do you answer them all? And they say, yes, we do, even if they're not there. So there's a commitment and a seriousness from that team, which is quite remarkable, which seems to be taking children seriously, which is quite interesting. They were promoting children's actions seriously. So these were the years of the World Children's Summit. It was covered by CIDA photographer David Barber, who showed children, took pictures of children who were talking at the UN from different countries and their choir. They had a special in Somewhere Today, which is the magazine for the older people, about the summit and about the kind of action that the vigils and the involvement that children can do for children's rights at home in a way. And this was also the year of a World Declaration for Children in Development. And so the magazines were talking about children's action and also publicizing what the UN had done. I'm finishing with the preservation and representations of images of humanity. So these are the boxes that Mark sent to Carlton because CIDA was about to throw them away. Their library did not want them. They took what they wanted. But Carlton has already acquired the whole library collection of CIDA because CIDA was dismantling it in their rush to close all the library. This is Mark in his office. And the archive at Carlton even bought the projector, closing photo camera, of Ottawa, old photo camera, so we can actually watch these strip films with the old machine that was designed in Germany in the 1920s. And so to conclude, I think, and I'll read that little bit, I think that there are things that story says about, or doesn't, this, that are a bit new and interesting, that the active learning of children, the emphasis on their public life, the importance of psychopedagogy, the explicit links between sensations and the visual that are really thought through in detail. There is also the presence of the children of the diaspora who are writing, why don't you speak about Madagascar, this is where I come from, speak about Chile, this is where I come from, and send a picture of their own country where they went on holiday or which they remember. Thank you very much.
All right, I'd like to invite
invite all four panelists to come up to the front. We do have some time for the questions that the panelists have written for us today, but then I'll make sure that we get to our engaged audience as well. So we may not quite get through all four questions that you've prepared, but
maybe you could ask the audience to participate
yes,
on each question as well.
Yes, that's way instead of at the end.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Right.
All right, the first question that our panelists have prepared nicely knits together the visual media components of their humanitarianism project. And certainly, too, if any members of the audience also would like to contribute to the questions, please do let me know, raise your hands, and let us introduce yourselves, too. First question for the panelists. How has humanitarian visual media figured in shaping the imagination of humanity and in formulating responses to human suffering? So our panelists already have those prepared questions, so I assume they have some answers that they've given some thought to. So I will pick a random person, so Sungrel, you'll start.
Okay. So spotlight on. Okay, so I haven't any written answers here, but what's interesting in the case of the two documentaries that I explored for this presentation is that it the way it sort of formulates a vision of humanity is by showing the inhumanity of war, and basically that's the operation or the way television operates in those two documentaries, and it raises the fundamental question, or both of those documentaries raise the fundamental question of how do war and humanity, how do they relate to each other? That's the core question behind those two documentaries. Is it, does warfare have an accepted place in the way one thinks about humanity? That's the question those two documentaries formulate. Now, the answer of the Red Cross throughout its history mostly had been, yes, there is a way to think of warfare and of humanity as being interrelated. It was established and founded as an agency that had as its goal easing the suffering of warfare, but it did not speak out against warfare as such. In fact, the Red Cross paradigm, up to the 1960s, was often, no politics and no moral judgments on those being involved in warfare. And that's what, those two documentaries by Hans-Dieter Grabe, that's what they also sort of attacked and criticized. They formulated very much a moral responsibility, not only to ease the suffering involved in warfare, but to speak out, a moral responsibility to speak out against war as such. So this notion of the role of visual media in formulating a new vision of humanity is very much at the center of those two, or was very much at the center of those two documentaries.
Yes, I think regarding this question, I think it's interesting also to understand how people got to see these images. So we need to think of visual media not only in terms of contents, which have been, there are many studies in humanitarian history focusing on understanding the representations and how they are made, but we should also think of visual practices in terms of practices of looking. So how did people got to see these images? How were they seen, when, and what was the surrounding context? Do we have any testimonials about how these images were perceived by the people? So in my case, humanitarian cinema at that time in the 20s was a collective experience. People would gather in the same place and live this social and mobilizing experience that shaped their humanity. So they would go to the movies and then be exposed to the repetition of messages, because that they would watch the movie, but then there would be many tracks, flyers, even exhibitions with many pictures. Some of them were pictures taken in the field, but some of them were just sort of screenshots taken from the movie. So they would be completely immersed in this visual universes that were completely shaping their answer and their responses. So the way they would act was shaped by the collective experience. Seeing was not an isolated act. So I think also in terms of visual media, which is also the approach we take in visual studies, is not only to reflect on the contents, but it also to be able to think on the surrounding experience, mainly related to the reception, even though it's one of the most complex issues when we talk about history to understand how people reacted in the past. It's a huge struggle, but I think there are ways, especially if we focus on the ways these images were seen and exposed and exhibited, I think there are ways also to understand how they were how people lived these images and how they perceived them.
As I was listening to all that, one of the things that is important, I think, is to think about the role of aesthetics and how people who produce these images think about it. So in this case, the introduction to one of the Families of the World books says, this is not meant to be beautiful, and this is not meant to be technical. It's meant to show you exactly what happened. But in reality, when I look at these books and how people reacted to them, they reacted to the beauty of it. So it's a funny thing. And these were photographers with real pride in the beauty of their pictures. So it's funny how people talk about the content and the style. Also, on the production of these images and how open they are, like the embedded journalists and the freedom of your fellow. I think there seem to be cycles of this, right? So where the media becomes like the introduction of the book I'm talking about says, this is against the media. The media is not doing their job in globalization. The information is bad. We're doing it against media. Whereas at times it's not so. These photographers are more friendly for the mainstream media, and so I think there's a cycle in the problem of legitimacy for the photographers, and then you see the public, I think, maybe contesting this or getting bored or not, you know, and there's a question also of their relationship with their public. And it's interesting to finish that in these pedagogical exercises that I saw, very few were actually explicitly asking children to learn to read images. It was quite boring, the exercises. It's like find the building material or count or describe the clothes. It was very, very technical. And it was nothing about the image and how it's constructed. No image literacy. I would have thought with all these photographers, but nothing. The only thing that there is the performative, like imagine that you are one, choose one person in the image, imagine you're them. And then the photo is one of many things like statistics and a story told to imagine that you are the mother of all.
So yeah, I guess when I was thinking of that question, I was thinking about how quickly ideas of humanity and humanitarian action shifted. So like in the case of Lewis Hines' photographs for the Red Cross, it was almost immediately after, at the end of the First World War, that interest in the American Red Cross's overseas work dropped completely. And so while his photographs, and I would agree that there's like an aesthetic to his photographs for sure. You can consider him like a poet with the camera. His images were removed from the magazine in terms of his overseas pictures and replaced with photographs that he'd taken before the war of child labor and to try and redirect people's attention to activities at home in the United States. And so there was a strong editorialization going on within the magazine that was reflecting some public perceptions in the United States at the time. There was also accusations that the Red Cross was funneling money or being really loose with their money. So there was a lot of politics happening with the American Red Cross at the time too. But it's interesting to see how that shift of humanitarian sentiment changes so quickly with the way in which the photographs are mobilized or not mobilized. So that's what I was thinking of when I was thinking of that question.
Any members of the audience want to engage with that question or anything that the presenters have given us to think about so far?
Just ask a technical question. How long
were the films in the 1920s? Depends, about 10 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes. Because of the technological restrictions, they couldn't be any longer. But I think the longest one was filming in Russia around 20 minutes. 20, about.
But your films are 3 minutes. You're
The documentaries? No, they're between 45 and 90 minutes.
Oh, I think it's hard.
Yeah.
No, just this one, just this surgery at the end, that was 3 minutes long.
Which probably seemed like 30.
It feels like 30.
When the documentary is shown like on a particularly prominent TV station in West Germany, or how did people... Mm-hmm.
Yes, I should have mentioned that. Sorry. So Germany in the 1960s just had basically two national TV channels, and it was shown on the second TV channel. But you know, at prime time, 8 o'clock or 8:15 in Germany, because the German news program Tagesschau usually runs from 8 to 8:15. So German programming, prime time programming starts at 8:15 in Germany, and both of those documentaries were shown at that time.
This question surrounds how the humanitarian visual response has shaped the institutions that our presenters talk about. So how have visual practices shaped humanitarian communication and the institutional identities of those organizations that you all talk about? So I'll just begin with Valerie.
What's interesting, as I was saying, was those organizations at that time were really looking at what each other was doing, and they were learning the good practices, but they were also cautious in not reproducing the same mistake that the others were doing when they were producing fundraising materials. So if you look at the bulletins that were produced by these organizations, such as the Record of the Save the Children Found or the International Review of the Red Cross, they are full of articles talking about what was the material produced by Save the Children when they went to Austria, when they went to Germany, or the contrary. So it's interesting to see how they were copying and observing each other. But there will be different institutional positions. So Save the Children was the first one to hire a professional photographer to do a movie, and they will maintain that line. They will work only with professional journalists to produce movies and pictures. So they really have a strong collaboration with the mass media and mainstream media. The American Relief Administration stopped in 1923, so there's no way to think about what they would have done if they had been an NGO up in the 50s or the 60s. But the ICRC, on the contrary, remained very skeptical about working with professional journalists. So they had to hire a local cameraman when they were making the movies in the 20s, but the scenario, the script, was made by the humanitarian delegates in the field. So the narrative was made by someone who was not a professional communication person. And it will be like this. I mean, until today, the ICRC prefers to produce a lot of the material by its own delegates. And the ICRC delegates are very famous in producing pictures, taking pictures in the field. They are still doing movies too, although a bit less. And since the 40s and 50s, the ICRC has been talking about the necessity to collaborate more with professional journalists and photographers, especially with television. But they were still very skeptical about the different, angles that are produced in humanitarian stories, whether they are made by humanitarian delegates or whether they are made by journalists. And they were afraid that journalists, for example, would not be interested in keeping things secret, especially since the ICRC is working in a very sensitive context. It was an issue for them to work with journalists because they said that if we work with them, they will ask us questions about things we are not supposed to talk about. So they were afraid of being too spoken out. So that's why they sort of restrained from working too much with journalists, although they had to, especially in the 80s, and they managed even to create a television studio in the headquarters in Geneva because they wanted to produce their own television show. Then they stopped it because they realized it was too much money and they didn't have the technical skills to do it. But there was these two institutions, Save the Children and ICRC, are a bit interesting because they explore the two extremes in terms of working with professional communication people.
Yeah, that was great. Good points. So with the American Red Cross, when the Americans entered the war, the First World War, it was really under the auspices of the American Red Cross. The American Red Cross had already been in Europe providing civilian relief, and so for them to have their publicity arm, especially in the magazine was its most public way of communicating with people, that really shaped their legitimacy, the legitimacy of the Americans being in the war, as their presence there being a humanitarian action, not necessarily although with military support, it was really supposedly under the guise of the Red Cross, although officially the American Red Cross did fall under the wing of the military, and all the members of the American Red Cross had to have military credentials and ranks and so on, which is an interesting mix of militarism and humanitarianism. But they were really building this idea that humanitarian action was a patriotic duty. And this really comes through in a lot of heavy-handed editorialization. And you can see that really clearly in Lewis Hines's work, because when he was working for other magazines, he had full control over how his photographs were going to be used. He could set up his own photo layouts, which he called Hinography. And he had his own terminology for it. And he always had control over the captions and so on. But once it went into the Red Cross magazine, he lost a lot of that control. And so a lot of the messaging shifted from being really about trying to connect with people, which was something that he really wanted to do. He really wanted to bridge connections between people from afar together and focus on what he called the human spirit, or what I would probably say is like ideas of human dignity across differences. And that got lost in this message of humanitarian action being a real duty of the American people. And then again, that changes at the end of the war. the Red Cross also hiring people like professional photographers like Lewis Hine and other social reform activists to help legitimate the organization being in Europe. So there was really this this need to have these professional artists and illustrators and photographers who already had this reputation to be in their magazine to help bolster their identity as being this really strong group that was the official aid organization of the American government.
Can I just add one point to what you said? I think there's a difference in the policies between Red Cross national societies and the ICRC. So I think the Red Cross societies had less problem to engage with professional photographers than the headquarters in Geneva.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, and I think if you look at the history between the ICRC and the American Red Cross in particular, the ICRC at that time was starting to see that the propaganda and publicity machine of the American Red Cross was really making them a high-profile organization,
and the
ICRC was starting to get
There's actors that are interesting, and in the institution of CEDA, there's the psychopedagogy people and a deep reflection on what that material is doing. For that, it took some money and it took some time, and that stuff, it was a one-off, and then it's gone from CEDA. I don't know where it is, but it's not really there like this anymore. After the mid-90s. There was also the physical bulk of that operation, which with the internet has vanished. And now on the email of the fellow who is the head of communication, it says, "Are you really sure that you want to print this?" Which is, I thought was really good, because, you know, that thing is all evanescent now. There's the whole work of curating the collection of material, and that is gone as well with the curator of the photo library. And it's sad because, and it's got to be reestablished. One way, this is programmatic, but the curating in a digital age is even more necessary because there's more stuff to curate, and that is gone. But there was a heyday. I mean, the curator was there. Sonia has interviewed her for almost 30 years, and it's a remarkable resource. This in Canada was world famous for that. There is also the value of artists and the value of the photographer and the illustrator. And then CEDA has abandoned almost that, not completely, but and, you know, value a lot the role of citizen journalists and citizen photographers. And there's a lot of good work done now about how does that change the news and how does that change information. It's not always for the better, that this kind of attention, artistic attention to the photo or the illustration is less deep, maybe, at times. One of the things we're doing Thursday in the workshop, we have a filmmaker coming who is committed to that kind of work. Yeah.
Okay, so what's interesting about my, or about Hans-Dieter Grabe and this generation of TV journalists is that by the time they enter television, the institutional identity of television and of television journalists begins to change in the 1960s. So TV journalists and journalists generally in Germany at that time begin to sort of form a critical ethos at that time. So critical reporting, the media as the watchdog of what the government is doing, those kinds of ideas and notions become very guiding among TV journalists at that time. And along with that, what's interesting about that is that along with that comes a change in visual practices or in the way they cover issues like war, for example. So, they use practices, camera perspectives, cuts, and so on, that differ from the way they had been used before. And that was one of the points I was trying to make, that's really the way that Gabe's documentaries were set up and organized. They used a counter aesthetic. They used counter practices and techniques of showing the war. And at the same time, those documentaries, and you can also see that in other documentaries, they start to adopt sort of traditional tropes, traditional visual tropes of humanitarianism for television. For example, the emphasis on the suffering body, which since the late 19th century, think of the Congo Reform Campaign or so, which since the 19th century is a guiding trope in the history of humanitarianism. And what Gabe and others do at that time, they pick up that trope, they adopt it for television, they use the advantages and the possibilities that that television offers to dramatize those tropes of the suffering body, and they in a way pave the way for a new sense of humanitarian responsibility with that. We usually think in the history of or in the contemporary history of humanitarianism, we often think of the Biafra crisis as the first founding moment of where photographs and television and so on become really important. But it's the Vietnam War and the Vietnam War coverage which paves the way for that. And from then on, television has become has formed a new institutional identity, humanitarian identity partly as well.
Any questions from the audience?
Thank you so much for your presentations and also your reflections. I was really interested in listening to you speak, thinking about this gulf, if you will, between the intentions and the reception of these visual products. And I also found myself thinking about the possibility of some kind of language around sanctioned representation or sanctioned engagements, because I got a sense from both the way you were presenting and the way you've been answering the questions that there's this moment where the states have a lot. State has a lot more control over how visual representations of humanitarian situations, humanitarian things are being presented. And then I think over the course of the 20th century, in the 21st, we've seen the state disappear from that very managed moment. So I'm curious to get your thoughts on that, this idea of some images are sanctioned, others are not. And I have one really specific question for Sonia. About the last slide that you showed and the juxtaposition you provided of historic photographs with more contemporary images, and I found it really interesting that you were able to find almost matching each one except for the image of Lake Virginia, the father and his two children.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we all have those visuals that really stay with us, and that's one of the images coming out of Syria's refugee movement that I just, it gets me every time, and there was no historical precedent for that. Representation, which is actually where all this is going to increase. Sorry, that's a very long
question. Might have to ask you for a very abbreviated response. But let's begin first with a specific question posed to Sonia, and then we can talk about state and its control of visual media, and then talk about the final question.
Fantastic. That's great. Yeah, thank you for noticing and pointing out that one picture on that slide. And it was deliberate that I put that in there, and I had intended to come back to it in discussion at some point. So thank you so much. I put that in there. That was actually a slide I had used in another presentation, but I just left the picture in there because it's a type of photograph that Lewis Hine would not take. He would not take photographs of people in their deep suffering and in that real moment of crisis. He wrote about it. He put those descriptions in captions. So some of his captions are like a paragraph long because he's really describing the circumstances around that led up to him being able to take pictures of that group of people or that individual. And so he'll definitely write about children having starved to death, women who've lost their husbands and or children who have died of different infections and diseases and so on. And so he really tries to record those horrific experiences, but he doesn't want to capture people in those precise moments. This idea, again, of the human spirit that he wants to focus on, or what I consider as being dignity, is really what he wants to try and capture. And I think that's because what he's responding to are those negative critiques that people have that refugees or immigrants are dirty, they're dangerous, they're whatever kind of negative term you want to throw out. He's trying to get people to empathize, to draw connections, to see that there are similarities, and so he's focusing on some of that more positive aspect. And I can get back into that again when we talk about the repetition of patterns of visual culture later on, but I see that as being something that he really builds on and that continues throughout the century with certain photographers. So that's why that picture was there with no historical corollary from his work, at least.
And to the broader question of the state being some kind of arbiter of what can be shown and what not, and just briefly because we are coming to the close of our session today.
Okay, I'll be short. So what you can see in the German context, and probably it's the same in Canada and the US, is that those types of documentaries from the 1960s, they often serve as a reference point for contemporary documentary filmmakers. But you don't get this type of war documentary anymore these days because the state or the U.S., you know, in the case of the Iraq War or so, has clamped down on the photo and film opportunities that filmmakers have to produce this kind of documentary, right? You know, you don't have this kind of it also involves a change of military strategy. So, you know, you don't have this kind of embedded journalists which go into the field where they can sort of film massacres or something like that, which how people burn down the houses of civilians and so on, which happened during the Vietnam War. So that doesn't happen anymore. And as a result of that, you don't get this, or you tend to not to get this kind of documentary anymore. At least that's my impression.
That's like violent, trying to say two things on that. The state can also be an enabler, just to push in the other direction. It's the Canadian, you know, Massey Commission thing. I'll explain that to you, Sonia and Valerie. But it's CEDAW-sponsored artists, and it's sponsored illustrators, and it's sponsored relatively autonomous teams of pedagogues. And in that way, this is not control, this is freedom. As Sonia found, some Canadian photographers who were doing other things got a lot of money, or not a lot, but enough money to do other things as well from CEDAW. So in that way, the withdrawal of the state is, you could say, more self-control. Like, people cannot do these trips like they used to before on state-sponsored thing. And also the fact that it's children it's hidden. So they had, that's why they were able to cut that service very quickly, because Mark said, you know, that was the first thing that went, the things for children. But at the same time, because it's only children, the conversation with the public might have been bolder because it was away from the radar of the politicians. So I think there is something interesting there.
I'll give the last word to Ellie.
Yeah, regarding the States, a humanitarian cinema in the 20s was completely autonomous and independent, so there was no clear position of the state. It will change later in the 50s, 60s, especially because advocacy will shift as a strategy, and it will become more confrontational or more aggressive, and some NGOs will become famous for criticizing states. The most famous example is Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. But what is important here is the national laws, which are limiting the NGOs in the country where they were created. So British NGOs are limited by the British Charity Act, which prevents them from having a political discourse. In Switzerland, it's a bit different, but the ICRC works hand in hand with the Swiss government, so they will do nothing that will harm the neutrality image of the Swiss government. So, and since the ICRC is working with governments, they don't really like, to be very confrontational, and they really keep to their duty of remaining silent. So, in these two cases, no, the state. I mean, yeah, it's not a very important case here. So.
Well, please join me in thanking the presenters, but I'd also like to thank Jill Campbell-Miller for the technical setup here, and I assume that the proceedings today are also going to be going on the Canadian Humanitarian Network.
Yeah, we'll try to post the audio.
We're experimenting with microphones.
This is our brand shiny new microphone.
Possibly, if you're a member of the network, you'll receive some kind of notification that the proceedings from this panel will be online, and so you can share it for all those who are interested who weren't able to come today. So thanks to Jill Campbell-Miller for facilitating that, and also to the panelists today for an excellent discussion of their research.